The advice given on this show is for informational purposes only. It is not intended as investment advice. Please consult a financial advisor before undertaking any investment decisions. While the show's producers have tried to provide accurate and timely information and have relied on sources they believe to be reliable, the show may include inadvertent technical or factual inaccuracies. Jack Monteith and Ken Smith do not warrant the accuracy or completeness of the materials provided and expressly disclaim any warranties or merchantability or fitness for a particular purpose.
Good morning and welcome to the Successful Investing Radio Show with me, Jack Monteith, and my business partner, Ken Smith. This is a show that's going to help you build wealth, protect your wealth, and to enjoy the fruits of your success. Ken and I have a combined 40 years of experience in the financial world, and we're partners in the successful wealth management firm of Empirical Wealth Management. We're here to share with you sound investment and financial advice, the same investment philosophy that Warren Buffett recommends for most individual investors, the passive approach. Most often, our show will feature a guest expert, and for today's show, we're very happy to have a tax expert here to talk to us about a little-known change to the capital gains law for 2008.
Jack, before we introduce today's guest, I'd like to share a little bit about our investment philosophy at Empirical Wealth Management and kind of the overriding theme of our show. On a week-to-week basis, we talk about different investment topics, but we put those topics through the light of our philosophy, our core belief system. And that is that we believe markets are very efficient. In 1966, the efficient market hypothesis was put forward. And this idea that trying to buy and time in and out of markets is not a way to succeed as an individual investor. And the idea that we don't buy individual securities in hopes of outperforming. We look for economic characteristics and relationships between risk and return. And we build globally diversified portfolios with what we believe are the best investment vehicles in the world, focusing on factors that we can control, like keeping the cost at the very bottom decile of expenses, managing taxes, and managing diversification.
Well, Ken, it's served our clients very, very well. So I'd like to invite our listeners that you can contact us at any time at contact@successfulinvestingradio.com. Or visit our website at www.empiricalwm.com. Empirical is EMPIRICALWM.com. And our listeners can also call us at 800-923-4307. Today's guest I'd like to welcome is Pamela Wilkinson. Pamela is a principal and shareholder with the CPA firm Wilkinson & Associates. Her husband, Russ, first opened the firm in 1983, and Pam joined in 1994. And they work side by side serving clients in Washington County in Oregon and Southwest Portland. Pam is also a licensed tax consultant and is a managing accountant at the firm. Welcome, Pam.
Thank you, Jack.
We know that there are some changes that have been made in the capital gains rates for 2008, and I think some of the changes are pretty exciting. Could you tell us about these changes for 2008?
Yes, there is a major change that is effective from 2008 on through 2010. It's actually effective for 2 years, and there are some real opportunities for some investors to take advantage of this new law. The lowest tax rate on capital gains will actually go down to zero in 2008.
Wow.
So that means you can possibly sell off some highly appreciated stocks or bonds that have been held long-term for greater than 1 year.
Well, who would qualify for a zero capital gains rate?
Right.
Pam, what type of income or would qualify for a zero capital gains rate?
Well, a couple filing jointly in 2008 could have up to $65,000 in income and still qualify for the 15% tax bracket. Now, taxable income is not your actual income. It's the income that results after you have deducted your itemized or standard deductions and the exemption. So that, for example, a retired couple might have $85,000 in income that's subject to taxes, but then they can deduct for the personal exemption of $7,000 and the standard deduction of $13,000, which reduces their taxable income down to $65,000.
Well, so let me get this straight. So let's say that a couple has, you know, $65,000 of income and $20,000 of capital gain. So are you saying that that capital gain on the federal level would be zero taxes?
That's correct.
Wow.
So they would only be taxed actually on the $65,000.
Well, how long does this benefit last? Is this just for 2008 or does it go into 2009? And
yeah, it actually is for 2 years, 2008 through 2010. And, of course, we don't know what Congress will do after that, if it'll be extended or not, but it is. The law is now for 2 years.
Okay, so what if can you if what other opportunities or challenges are we seeing with the capital gains tax?
Okay, just in general, just to explain how gains and losses relate to one another. Gains and losses from sales of investment property are actually netted to come up with a net gain or a net loss.
Okay.
Okay, so they're first segregated into two groups, your short-term gain or loss and your long-term gain or loss. Short-term is what the term that's used for assets that are owned for 1 year or less. Long-term is the term used for assets owned more than 1 year. So, first of all, short-term capital gains and losses are netted. So you put the two together and come up with either a gain or a loss. And then likewise, your long-term capital gains and losses are netted. Now,
well,
if there are net gains in both short-term and long-term, then the short-term gain is taxed at the ordinary income rate, whatever that is for the taxpayer. The net long-term gain qualifies for capital gain tax rate, which we said was a maximum 15%.
Okay. Well, Pam, what if the taxpayer has losses, and let's just take an example. What if the taxpayer has net losses of $20,000, and if we're only limited to $3,000 in loss, what happens to the balance?
Well, you can actually deduct up to $3,000 per year against your ordinary income, and any excess loss is carried forward to a future tax year. And that can be carried forward indefinitely.
Okay. Pamela, if our listeners are interested in getting a hold of you, how would they make contact with you?
Well, a variety of ways. We do have a website. It's www.wilkinsoninc.com. Wilkinson Inc. is one word, WILKINSONINC.com. Also, our email would be contact@wilkinsoninc.com. As well, they can reach us by phone at 503-693-7242.
Great. Well, thanks for sharing that information and being with us today, Pam. And you know, maybe we can have you on future shows.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks
so much.
Thanks a lot, Pam.
Ken, today's discussion topic that I'm really excited about is you know, it's building a bond portfolio for these changing and challenging times. You know, I know that at Empirical Wealth Management, as the Empirical Wealth Management investment team leader, you know, you and your assistant Stephen Guichard put a lot of time and research into this, and frankly, I'm very, very impressed with your bond portfolio that we're providing for our clients. So can you give us a little background on what motivated you to come up with your bond strategy? And then let's talk about the components of this bond strategy.
Yes, Jack, I appreciate this discussion, and thanks for asking about it. Because I think this is an area that sometimes investors discount as being a very simple area, and actually it's not. It can be very complicated, and all too often I find that investors take an approach to bonds that is contrary to their best interests. And, you know, I thought maybe we'd talk a little bit about some of the general findings as Steve and I were doing research and have continued to do it over the last several years, of what the academics say about how a person should view fixed income in their portfolio.
Right, because, yeah. You know, what we see so often is people come to us and they have they have 5 or 6 bonds or 10 bonds, and they say, you know, we're good to go and just let things ride.
Right, right. Well, one of the things that we looked at is, you know, what we started asking the question, what is the purpose of having fixed income in a portfolio? And, you know, studies have been done over very long periods of time now on equities, and the result has been the same, that over longer periods of time, if an investor has a time horizon, you will not find a time period, say, of 30 years or more, where bonds did better than equities. So for the person who's going after total return or the highest rate of return, and you have a long time horizon, stocks are actually less risky than bonds in terms of risk being defined as beating inflation or staying ahead of inflation.
Purchasing power.
Right.
Yeah.
So the question then is, why would someone own bonds in their portfolio if they were a longer-term investor? And that question comes down to tempering volatility. You know, in any one particular year, even if we eliminate all of the unnecessary risk by diversifying and owning stocks from all around the world, even our global portfolios, and we backtest those in the last 30 years, there's been a single 12-month period of time you could find where an all-equity portfolio declined over 30% in one 12-month period, right?
Right.
And so really, as we measure someone's risk tolerance and we separate risk tolerance from their capacity to take risk, which might include their time horizon, you would put bonds in the portfolio. And a Nobel Prize winning academic by the name of James Tobin started studying this actually back in 1958, came up with what's called the separation theorem. He said the reason you'd really have bonds in a portfolio is to temper that short-term volatility.
Right.
And some people use them for income. They like the fact that they pay income. But you and I, we've traditionally tried to use a total return approach to getting income, you know, selling off principal or capital gains from the equity side in addition to the bond to get the income we need.
Yes.
So our view and our position for our clients is why we own bonds would be to reduce volatility, short-term volatility in the portfolio. Well, if you want to do that, you know, you have to really understand the different segments of the bond market and what segment allows you to do that the most. And when we build a portfolio, we look at, you know, what we would call a risk budget. I have a certain amount of budget for risk I'm willing to spend. How should I spend that so I get the highest rate of return on that budget? And one of the things we found is that keeping maturity shorter gives you a higher budget of risk. So, you know, it's important to look at return on a gross basis or just total return, right? But one of the things we preach constantly to our clients is, well, we need to understand the risk. You know, if you come and say, my friend was with so-and-so advisor and last year they beat the pants off of this portfolio, right? And the first question we usually say is, well, how much risk are they taking to get that kind of return?
Right.
And so you need to be putting things in the light of how much risk. And so there are things called the Sharpe ratio out there or the information ratio that you can look at. And what they found is that in simple examples, beyond 5 years, if you look at your treasury bonds, you know, over the last 40 years, and you said, hey, I bought 5-year treasury bonds and I bought 20-year treasury bonds. By extending the maturity, typically you do get a higher rate of return. But there's a point in which, on a risk-adjusted basis, it's a very bad bet to make. And when you go beyond from 5 to 20 years, you got an extra 10 basis points or 10 one-hundredths of a percent return.
One-tenth of 1%.
Exactly. One-tenth of 1% extra return, but you took on 75% more volatility in that bond portfolio.
Right. So isn't that our opinion or our position that if you're going to go very long with those bonds and incur the extra risk, you might as well be in stocks?
Exactly. If you're willing to take that kind of risk on, getting an extra 0.1% return is not the best return on your risk budget that you've spent.
Right.
Go into equities where you expect to get for 75% more volatility by including more equities in the portfolio, and then we can even tilt towards higher returning components like small cap or emerging markets, those things. You've gotten a better per unit risk versus return benefit there. So the first thing we do and we encourage people to do is keep the maturities to 5 years and lower. And there's things you can look at. You want to look at the average maturity, and you also want to keep your eye on what's called duration. And duration is really a measure of when you account for the fact that bonds typically make coupon payments. You get some money back along the way before that bond matures. Bonds that are paying higher coupon payments, or bond funds that are buying bonds that pay higher coupon, have a lower duration than a zero coupon bond, right? That doesn't pay any interest until maturity. So the higher the duration, the more volatility. And so you want to kind of keep an eye on both of those. And our goal is typically to keep the average maturity around 5 years or less, and the duration below that 5 year number. So that's the first thing we would do. The second thing we looked at is, well, okay, we didn't get paid for taking on a lot of maturity risk or going extending maturities. Do you get paid looking at credit? Because other type of risk when you're dealing with bond market is credit risk is another one. There's about 8 major risks, but we're focusing on maturity and credit risk right now. And credit risk is, I could buy treasury bonds, right, that really have the full faith and backing of the U.S. government. They've never defaulted. And that kind of sets the bar, as it were, for the most safe in bond investment out there. And when you buy corporate bonds, there's a chance those bonds may default. And there are rating systems out there. S&P and Moody's are the two major rating systems. And S&P is an example. They start with AAA, AA, single A, BBB, and then they go down into the C's. And anything below BBB is basically considered junk or high yield bonds. So in order to take credit risk, one of the questions we asked is it worth taking the credit risk, the risk that these bonds might default? And one of the things to look at is if you go back to 1926 and you use Ibbotson's data and you look at corporate bonds, and we're using long-term corporates versus long-term governments. Long-term government bonds have averaged about 5.5% per year. Long-term corporate bonds have averaged about 5.8. So on the long end of the curve, there was very little, if any, risk credit risk premium to be had.
Ken, I have, looking at your bond portfolio, I have 3 questions for you.
All right.
First of all, I see, you know, there's inflation-protected bonds in here.
Uh-huh.
Number 2, I see where you have international.
Yeah.
And number 3, as you just began to speak of, I don't see any, I don't see any corporate bonds.
Well, we do have some corporate bonds in there, and where we focus the corporate bonds, though, are in the 1 to 3 year position. So the we're using a fund that's targeting only investment grade bonds, and they're in the 1 to 3 year maturities. And so, as I was saying, on the long end, there's been no credit, really much credit premium at all. Where there has been some credit premium is if you stayed in the highest tier, and when then we're talking about looking on a risk adjusted basis, where did you get the highest information ratio or payment? It's been on the shorter end of the curve, and it's been keeping them in the highest tier, in the investment grade tier. So we've made a concentration that says, hey, if we're going to take any credit risk, and we've got about 30% of our bond portfolio exposed to credit, mm-hmm. Through corporate bonds, we want that to be in an area where we've gotten the highest risk-adjusted return, and that's been on the shorter end of the yield curve. So we're using treasuries on the short and kind of an intermediate part of the curve, but then we're focusing, the only place we have credit is on the very short end of the curve.
I see.
Yeah. And there's a great paper, you know, in doing our research called The Risk Premium of Corporate Bonds by Alexander Kozamykin. It appeared in the Journal of Wealth Journal of Portfolio Management. And he has a great table that kind of illustrates this.
Well, address the other two issues, which would be, I see the inflation-protected bonds, and I see you're invested internationally on the bonds.
Right. Well, back in 1997, the Treasury started issuing TIPS, which are Treasury inflation-protected securities. And basically, this allowed investors that are exposing themselves to the bond market to have to eliminate another risk that we face as bond investors. And one of the risks is inflation risk.
Sure.
The idea that, you know, if you look at our treasury bills over the last, since 1926, they've really barely kept pace. pace if kept pace with inflation. And so what's unique about these tips, and we've got a pretty good allocation to them, is that they eliminate one other risk in investing with bonds. So one, we're getting rid of the credit risk because we're staying on treasuries on those tips. And then two, we are eliminating inflation risk entirely, because what these bonds do is they'll pay a stated coupon rate, and they're issued at par, which means that if you if it's a $1,000 bond, that's what they're issued at. And basically each year, based on the consumer price index for urban prices, it adjusts the value of the bond up. So we want to have that in there because we want to have a component of the bond portfolio that hedges out that inflation risk. The other major benefit with tips and keeping maturity short, Jack, is that they have a lower correlation to the equity part of our portfolio. Anytime we look at adding anything into our portfolio, we look at how it works or what the correlation is to the rest of the portfolio. And so we consider it in a total return, kind of a total portfolio mix. And that leads into the international component. Why do we have international bonds? Well, it's not that we're expecting a higher rate of return over a long period of time, but what we found is that the international component has a very low correlation to both the U.S. component of our portfolio, our bond portfolio, and the global equity portfolio that we have. So the goal when we're trying to build a portfolio is say, hey, for a given amount of risk budget that our client has to spend, how can we get them the maximum amount of return or minimize the risk for a given return that they need to have?
Great job on this bond portfolio, and great job to your team, Ken.
Oh, thank you very much, Jack.
Moving right along, we're going to move on to our regular feature, which is being a smart investor. And before we do that, I'd like to remind our listeners you can contact us at contact@successfulinvestingradio.com, which is all Successful Investing Radio, all one word, or visit us on our website, www.empiricalwm.com. Empirical is EMPIRICIALWM. Or you can contact us by phone at 1-800-923-4307. 1-800-923-4307.
Jack, I wanted to mention in Seattle on June 6th, we are going to have an investment education class.
Oh, great.
And kind of the title of this particular class, and we're developing a whole series of kind of a university type of approach here to building for our listeners to come in and get some of the building blocks. To teach themselves and educate themselves on how capital markets work and how to build a successful investment approach. And so this one's going to go through some of the basic fundamentals, and we title it How to Have a Successful Investment Experience During Turbulent Market Times. And you and I know that the market's always pretty turbulent, but if you're interested in that, give us a call or check our website and you can click in and sign up for that.
Yeah, it's an awesome seminar, and I highly recommend it. Well, Ken, you're our company's Empirical Wealth Management's chief investment officer, so I get to ask you all the tough questions. So here we go, defining investment terms. What do you mean by active management when discussing active manager when discussing mutual funds?
Well, basically, when in the world of mutual funds, there are two major classes. You have active managers and passive managers, and we talk about passive. Basically, an active manager is trying to, through its proactive efforts of security selection, they're trying to add some return over a benchmark. And that benchmark might be an index. And typically, if it's large companies they're buying, they might say, the S&P 500 is my benchmark, and I'm going to actively manage this fund. And actively means they're in there day in and day out researching the companies in the S&P 500, meeting with management. I mean, this is one of the sales pitches of the active managers, and we know them very well. I'm in there meeting and interviewing the management. I'm scrubbing through financial reports. I'm doing all these things. I'm looking at the economy. And, there's bottoms up, there's bottoms down, and all these kinds of things. What they're trying to do is add some return. And a lot of times, about 90% of the time, they don't. So we don't employ active managers, and we'll forego an asset class entirely. We've done that many times if the only choice we have is an active manager to choose from, because they've been so inefficient, and you have so much tracking error, the risk of, you know, a particular index, like the S&P is up 20% in a year, and your active manager is 10% return.
I go back to the introduction of the show every morning when we mentioned that, you know, if Warren Buffett is recommending that most investors take a passive or an index approach, you know, you better sit up and listen.
Right.
Well, Ken, you know, time goes by so quickly, and I just want to mention our next show, and our guest expert, which actually is going to be your assistant, Stephen Kuchard, of Empirical Wealth Management, and Stephen's going to be discussing hedge funds, you know, what they are, and should you be investing in one. And you know, my standard take on investing is, you know, if you don't thoroughly understand your investments or you don't understand the terms, you shouldn't be investing. And so it'd be very interesting to hear Stephen's take on that. And then Ken, you and I will be sharing ideas on how the new investor can get started on a lifetime of investing program. You know, how do you get started? So I'm
excited.
Me too.
The advice given on this show is for informational purposes only. It is not intended as investment advice. Please consult a financial advisor before undertaking any investment decisions. While the show's producers have tried to provide accurate and timely information and have relied on sources they believe to be reliable, the show may include inadvertent technical or factual inaccuracies. Jack Monteith and Ken Smith do not warrant the accuracy or completeness of the materials provided and expressly disclaim any warranties or merchantability or fitness for a particular purpose.
I'm Bob Howie, attorney and president of the board of Boyer Children's Clinic. When a child is diagnosed with a disability, it can be devastating. For more than 65 years, Boyer Children's Clinic has been serving young children with disabilities like cerebral palsy and autism. The people at Boyer know that these kids can live rich, productive lives. They know how to help the families so that each of these little ones can reach their greatest potential. More than 550 children come to Boyer every year for speech therapy, physical and occupational therapy, early childhood special education, and family support. Investing in children is always a sound strategy. Boyer offers multiple ways to give. You can donate to the endowment fund to make a long-term impact. You can give a gift that helps children today. Either way, your contribution to Boyer Children's Clinic will change the future for these boys and girls. Please go to boyercc.org or phone 206-325-8477. That's 206-325-8477 for more information.